Still working our way through the Psalms here tonight. Now, as we pointed out last week, a lot of scholars connect Psalm chapter 9 and Psalm chapter 10 together. There are a lot of indications that it was at one time possibly one long psalm, but somewhere along the line it got split into two. And it stands on its own as its own psalm, so I don't think it does any damage to the thing that it is separated into a separate psalm. This psalm is one that actually has no author designated at all, and that's unusual for this section, for the first book of the Psalms like this. That's another reason why they assign it to being at the very least a companion piece to Psalm chapter 9. Most scholars believe that this is written by David. But there's no way to prove that. Now this is a psalm that's going to be talking about the seeming prosperity of the wicked. It's a lament. It's a psalm that's a lament, kind of talking about the way that that people who don't follow God's ways seem to succeed really well, seem to actually do real well, as though God is being unjust in all of this. But ultimately, it resolves in a confidence in God and in His justice and His righteousness, which will ultimately prevail. You know, when we look at these, and we've talked about these psalms of lament, it's an important thing to keep in mind, important thing to remember about the Psalms, is that the Psalms aren't a textbook. The Psalms are not something that we're going to read and weren't designed necessarily, initially, let's put it that way, or primarily as something for us to create a framework of theology from. We do. We pull all kinds of theology from it. But the Psalms basically provide for us a language with which we can speak to God. And I think that's a really important aspect of this, is when we look at these and we realize that there's a lot of laments when it comes to the Psalms. I mean, we run the whole gamut of human emotion in these. There's laments. There are times of rejoicing. There are complaints. There are moments of sorrow and sadness. There are moments of extreme joy. There's actually anger and even hatred demonstrated in the words of the Psalms, the words that God provided for us to speak to Him. You know, and you think about that. Oftentimes, I think that we're reluctant to get real honest with God. I think a lot of times we end up praying what we think God wants to hear. We kind of put on our Sunday best in our vernacular to speak to God, and oftentimes we'll avoid those things that we immediately assign as being the things that we're not supposed to be, instead of just being honest and upfront and open with God about where we're coming from. David had no compunction, and the psalmist writers had no compunction about being absolutely frank with God, upset with Him at times, angry at circumstances at times, vitriolic at moments as they're speaking about their enemies. God is big enough. That's the thing that we've always got to remember, even when it comes to our own things that we go through as human beings. God can handle it. God can handle our anger. God can handle our hatred. He can deal with it, and He's the one who can. I can't handle it very well. When you come and talk to me about it, I get a little bit antsy about it. Why do you want to talk like that? But God can take it. God is the one who can take it. So He's the one that we absolutely should be honest with. And the Psalms teach us that. If we learn nothing else, we want to learn that. This is about being raw and real with God. No fancy footwork intended in any of this. Just coming before God and speaking our hearts and our minds before Him, because He's there and He cares. Okay, so we begin this Psalm chapter 10. We'll read the first four verses as we set the stage for this. He says, "Why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide in times of trouble? The wicked in his pride persecutes the poor. Let them be caught in the plots which they've devised. For the wicked boasts of his heart's desire. He blesses the greedy and renounces the Lord. The wicked in his proud countenance doesn't seek God. God is in none of his thoughts." Okay, the psalm begins with that age-old question. And it's certainly a question that has been posed by more than just the writer of this psalm. And that's the question, why? Why? Why doesn't God stop all the evil that happens in this world? That's one of the things that we as Christians face a lot of times. Haven't you ever heard that argument? Hasn't anybody ever said that to you? You know, if God is good, if God's really there, then why is there so much pain all around us? Why are all these things, you know, happening like this? It's described perfectly in this psalm, the way it's written here. The psalmist, it pictures God as afar off, as being absent, an absentee God, or worse, as hiding. Why are you hiding when we're in trouble here and you're off somewhere else? And the sense is that the writer feels this despair, and he's in the midst of some kind of despair, and God doesn't seem to be attending to it. God doesn't seem to notice it from appearances, from the way he's looking at it initially here. Waiting around for God to come and save the day, and God doesn't seem to be showing up in time. Verse 2 kind of explains why he feels this despair. The wicked in his pride persecutes the poor. And so right away, you know, we've got this sense here, this unopposed oppression of the poor and the weak. That's always a recipe for something that should be getting God's attention in most cases. The Bible always portrays the oppression of the weak, the oppression of the poor, as something that's identified as wicked. We never want to be on the side of the oppression of the poor, never, unless we want to be in God's sights. I mean, that's just the way that is. That's the way he expresses that in his word. And here we see that whoever is propagating this wickedness is not only boasting of their own self-will, of what it is that they want to do, and not as only is operating out of a motive of this sort of antagonism towards God and his purposes, but he's also, clapping on the back the people that do other kinds of evil. Raises up his own desires in opposition to God, and also seems to validate those who do the same thing. And in fact, he's employing that kind of parallelism we talked about before. The wicked bless the greedy and renounce God. You've got that same kind of rhyming ideology there. And when it says, when it says renouncing God, it means to show contempt for him, to have absolute contempt for God and his plans and his purposes, what he's doing. And how this actually describes how a person has contempt for God. You wonder how. We use a term like that. We say, well, he's got contempt for God, and immediately we can say, well, yeah, that's a bad person. That's one of the bad guys, a person who has contempt for God. But he explains what this is displayed in through this elevated sense of importance that he says he doesn't need God. That's what he's saying there. His proud countenance doesn't seek God. So the renunciation of God, this contempt for God, is displayed in a life that feels like we can do it on our own. Someone who goes out and says, well, I have no need of God. I have no need of religion. I don't need all these spiritual things cluttering up my life. I've got my own plans and purposes for my life. That is described here as being contemptuous of God. And also because God's not in his thoughts, he says, which means God's plan is not his guide at all. He doesn't stop to think, well, what does God want in all these things? What is God's will or purposes? But he determines what he wants, what he's going to do, and he does it on his own. He's not even interested in following God's plan for life, so he renounces him. That's one of the things about the Bible. It doesn't provide us a lot of middle ground when it comes to God. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, but even like this case here, the way a person is showing contempt for God is by not being concerned for what God's plans are. You'd almost think, well, that doesn't mean, a guy could be out doing really nice things, but if he's not doing it according to God's plan or God's purposes, the implication in all these things is that he's going in the wrong course, and he's actually disdaining God in the process. And you think about Jesus when he talked about those who don't gather with me scatter abroad. Whoever's not for me is against me. Sometimes people will say, well, look, I got nothing against Jesus. I got nothing against, any of that stuff. It just doesn't work for me right now. It's just not part of my plan. But the Bible actually doesn't make room for that. There's no middle ground like that there. Jesus said, you're either going to be on my side or you're going to be against me. There's only two sides in this whole thing. That's actually kind of alarming when you start thinking about it. There's only two sides. There's only two pathways. That's what the Duduke said. Only two paths. One is the path to life, and the other is the path to death. And it's things like that that we have to stop every once in a while and contemplate. First and foremost, we thank God that He saved us and He turned our hearts. But also, we want to recognize some of the patterns that develop in the world around us and the thinking that's represented in the culture around us, and recognize that there's a huge disparity between the thinking, the status quo of the culture, and what it is that God has described as being His plans and purposes for life. Okay, so this psalm goes on, verses 5 to 7. He's talking about, still talking about the wicked person. He says, His ways are always prospering. Your judgments are far above, out of His sight. As for all His enemies, He sneers at them. He said in his heart, I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue is trouble and iniquity. Okay, so this is worded a little bit clumsily, but in the original language, it's actually kind of difficult to translate. But it seems to be protesting that not only do the wicked always seem to prosper, the guys that are doing the wrong things are the guys that, you know, seem to be making all the money and seem to be getting all the things going their way, but they do so because God's judgments seem so far off. It seems like it's way off, somewhere out of sight, far away from where they are. And so he does what he wants, and he has no opposition. He does whatever he feels like doing, and nothing's getting in his way. And it says he sneers at his enemies. In other words, anybody who would oppose him in what it is that he wants to do, he just sneers at that, scoffs at that, clearly indicating that he's got enough power and ability to do whatever it is that he wants to do that nobody can withstand it. He just goes, you know, no one can resist him. You know, this is really a picture of a bad person when you look at that. I mean, immediately your mind starts conjuring up all of the really bad guys and all the different movies you've seen in your life or whatever. And yet, in a lot of ways, this is a picture of the enemy. When we look at this and we think about the world, you know, we started with that question. Where's God? Why? Why is all this bad stuff happening in this world? Where is He in the midst of this? We could actually take this out of the microcosm in the immediate circumstances that David's talking about and bring it back and look at it in the macro story here and realize that this is a picture of our enemy. This is a picture of our enemy at work in this world, especially when we look at the circumstances of this world and the state that this world is in. I mean, this is who he is. This is how he operates. This is a description of our one real enemy, and that's Satan, the devil. Whatever name we want to apply to him, it means the same thing. He's an enemy. He's an enemy to our souls. He's an enemy to our lives. He hates us. He works against us. And yet, strangely enough, we keep allying ourselves with him in so many different ways. It's an odd conundrum that we find ourselves in. Verse 8. Here's a description of him. The description continues. He sits in the lurking places of the villages. In the secret places, he murders the innocent. His eyes are secretly fixed on the helpless. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lies in wait to catch the poor. He catches the poor when he draws him into his net. So he crouches, he lies low, that the helpless may fall by his strength. He said in his heart, God has forgotten. He hides his face. He will never see. Wow. That's a pretty hopeless picture here. As you look at it, here's this image that the writer here uses. We'll assume it's David, somebody who's obviously familiar with wildlife, probably watched a lot of Discovery Channel or National Geographic and was familiar with the way those lions would move. Because immediately when he paints this picture with his words here, you get that imagery, don't you, of a cat? Do you have a house cat? I got house cats, and they do the same kind of thing. You know, when they see something that catches their attention, they fix their eyes on it. You know, you can wiggle your toes or whatever, and they immediately stop and they slink down and they work their way towards their prey. That sense of stalking something, that sense of secrecy in the whole thing, of trying to stay hidden. And of course, we certainly know that we apply that to our enemy as well. One of the things that the New Testament tells us is our enemy You know, he doesn't go around in a red spandex suit with a pitchfork displaying, you know, devil across it somewhere or anything like that. He appears as an angel of light. He does things in secret. He works in ways that are not that obvious apart from the end result of it, apart from the stench that it leaves around it as we recognize the pain and the heartache that's associated with him. But, you know, here's this image of a cat-like predator going after the weak, going after the poor. And of course, that's what our enemy does, always going after those who are defenseless, those who are weaker, those who aren't in a position to be able to defend themselves well. And I also think about how, like, mean cats are. You ever think about how cruel they are? They never just pounce on their food and be done with it. They got to play with it a little while. You know, they got to, you know, if you ever, I sit there and watch my cats with the little toy mice, and I feel bad for the little toy mice after a while because, you know, they'll bat it down and then they hold it and then they wait for it and they bat it around and kick it around. If you ever see them with a lizard, they do the same thing. They're going to hold it for a little, let it squirm and squirm. And then when it stops, they lift off their paws, say, "Oh, go ahead, go." And the thing starts to take off and wham, down again. You know, it's just, they're just mean. And that's the way our enemy is. See, cats are of the devil, just in case you didn't know. Just kidding. I got two cats. I can say that. It actually fits a description that the New Testament provides for us, 1 Peter 5:8. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. That's the picture there. And it's the same imagery that David uses here in describing. And realize that I understand. In the context, David is talking about human beings. I believe David is talking about the real enemies that he was facing in life. From the larger perspective that we have now that Christ has come, we see a fuller picture. So we can use these Psalms and apply that then to the bigger picture, to understanding the way our enemy works in our midst. The psalmist, you know, laments that they feel like these enemies can do this, this work of evil can do this, because it seems like God's forgotten. In fact, those are the little last words that he says in his heart, God's forgotten. He hides his face. He's never going to see this. You know, one time at a church picnic, they had a big long table set out, and on one end of the table there was a basket filled with candy bars, and a little sign beside it said, please just take one. And then underneath it, it said, remember, God is watching. And on the other side of the table, there was a big plate of chocolate chip cookies. And a little sign by it said, take as many as you want. God's watching the candy. So, you know, the thing is a lot of times we get that feeling. Like, God's looking at someone. God's watching the candy bars. God isn't paying attention to what I'm doing. And sometimes we feel like that. Sometimes we feel like God's nowhere around. We're going through circumstances and difficulties, and we're facing things that are just tearing us apart. And it just feels like God has forgotten about us, as though our enemy can do whatever he feels like doing and does it unopposed, as though God's watching something else and forgetting about attending to our needs. Anybody ever felt like that? I certainly have in my experiences following Christ. There have been a lot of times where I've been trying to figure out where God is in the midst of all of this, and all of the pain that's going on. So we wait and we wonder and we wonder. We wonder where God is or if God cares. So then the psalmist goes on, because that's the bleak side of the psalm. That's the realistic side. That's the side that's speaking raw and real from the heart about real life experiences. And then it goes on then. The psalmist seems to shake himself just a little bit here. We read in verse 12, arise, O Lord. O God, lift up your hand. Don't forget the humble. Why do the wicked renounce God? He said in his heart, he will not require an account, but you have seen. For you observe trouble and grief to repay it by your hand. The helpless commits himself to you. You are the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and the evil man. Seek out his wickedness until you find none. Okay, so here he starts off. You can sense that he's getting a different picture here. He's suddenly changing his perspective here. And he cries out, arise, O God. And in essence, you could paraphrase that and say, do something, God. Do something about this situation. It's like he's had enough. You know, we go this far, but then it's like, stop this. This is terrible. I've had enough of this. And he's shaking himself and he's reminding himself about what he knows. And by doing that, he's suddenly changing his focal point. He's suddenly changing what it is that he's got his attention fixed on. He knows that in and of himself, he's not able to stop this wickedness. He, as a human being, as this person that he is, whatever his situation is here, he is personally not able to make the difference here. He can't make this stop. You can't stop this wickedness. It's beyond him, but he also knows that it's not beyond God. That no matter what's going on here, it's not beyond God's ability and his power. No matter what he's seen so far, he's remembering, he's reminding himself of what he knows. I know that God is able to take care of this situation. And he reminds himself about what he knows about God. He says, you have seen, you do observe the trouble and the grief of your people. You are just in these things. That's a summary of what he's getting across. So what he's doing is he's looking past the problem now. He starts off, his focus is completely on everything that's wrong. In fact, he uses plenty of descriptors there because he's had plenty of time to think about it, because he's just been thinking about it, because that's what we do as human beings. When everything begins to fall apart and the problems begin to mount up, that's what we do. We fixate on those things. We look at those things. We focus on those things. But here we see what's going to make the difference is what made the difference for the psalmist here. He begins to shift his focus. And he goes back to what he knows about God. Here's what I remember about God. He does hear. That's what he said. That's what he's revealed about himself. He does care about these things, about the plight of his people. These are things that are important to him. And so when he remembers these things about God's character, that he is a helper. He is a hero. He is the one who comes to provide the help that we need, that we can commit our plight to him because he does care. Even though we don't see it immediately, we know that that's what he's revealed about himself, that he has done that. He's that kind of a God. And so when he begins to see it from that perspective, reminding himself of what he knows about God, then he begins to call out for some specific things. And then he starts saying, now God, get in here and help me by breaking the arms of my enemy, which is kind of rough. You know, you look at that and say, man, this God's kind of hardcore. But what we have to understand too is there's imagery being employed in this. To break the arm of somebody is to remove their power. That's the concept behind it. You break somebody's arm, they don't have the power to exercise their control or oppress any longer. And honestly, as it touches my enemy, I'm all about praying that. I pray that all the time. God, break the arm of my enemy. Stop him from what he's doing here. I look at the people that I love, that he hurts and that he's messing with, and I pray that all the time. God, break my enemy's arms. Ruin what he's doing. Ruin everything that he's about. Bring all of his plans to nothing, God. There's nothing wrong with praying that. I reserve all of my hatred for him. And I hate him, as the Bible says, with a perfect hatred. I will hate that which is evil, and I'll cling to that which is good. And this is what David is representing here. He's asking God to stop this, to disarm what's happening here in this oppression. And then he wants God to scour the area and remove all traces of what the wicked were up to. In other words, just get in there and hunt it all down, Lord. Just get it all out of here, because this is horrible stuff. And eventually, we are promised that God will do that. God will eventually settle all accounts. God will make everything right. His justice ultimately will prevail. I know that, you know, Riley's usually the one who talks about Braveheart, and it's an okay movie. It's not one of my favorites. I'm sorry, but there is a scene in there that always stuck with me. That in the beginning of the movie, when William Wallace's wife is taken by the British for the English, and she's about to be executed, and it was unusual in the movies at that time. It's kind of used a lot now, but at the time it was unique, and it was a little different. In the movie, she's sitting there looking up at the hills, like she's waiting at any moment for him to come riding over the crest of the hill to deliver her and rescue her and save her. And even the way it's shot kind of gives you that sense that you're waiting for this rescue to happen, and boom, she's executed, and he doesn't show up in time to change that. Those events actually happen. Now, The thing about it is, William Wallace in that movie does show up. He does show up, and he shows up with a sword. And he shows up, and he removes every trace of what was there creating that oppression. You know, the fact of the matter is we're not always promised exactly what's going to happen in the circumstances of this world, in this fallen world that we're in this enemy-occupied territory. We're not always promised that it's going to be, you know, candy and roses and popcorn and mayonnaise. Well, mayonnaise, I don't know why, but I mean, I'm glad we're not promised it's going to be that, because that's gross. Chocolate or whatever. I mean, we're not promised ham and eggs every morning. We're just not. But we are promised. We are promised that he will show up. We are promised that a good ending will come and justice will prevail. So we trust in that. We find our hope in that. We cling to that in believing that he will provide that. Okay, moving on here, finishing up this psalm, verses 16 to 18. It says this, "The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations have perished out of his hand. Lord, you've heard the desire of the humble. You will prepare their heart. You will cause your ear to hear, to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, that the man of the earth may oppress no more." Well, that's a wonderful way that he finishes it off. It's a completely different scenario from the way the psalm begins. He begins way down here in the depths. It ends way up here in that sense of hope that he has got in God. In the first section, the last section here, the nations have perished out of his land. I said hand when I was reading it, but it's out of his land. And the concept there is that the psalmist is reminding himself of what God's already done. When the Israelites came in to the promised land that God had provided for them, he removed those that were in opposition to them. He removed them out of his land. God did that. And that's what the psalmist is reminding himself of. He's not even just going back to the things that he knows about him from his word, but he's going back to the experiences that were there. He's remembering what God's done in the past. God has come through before. We've seen his hand at work. We've seen the kind of things that he's capable of doing that I know that he'll do again. It gives you the impression when the fact that he's using this concept of the nations there, it gives you the impression that the writer, which more than likely is David, is facing real enemies like the Philistines who were coming and oppressing various villages that he was having trouble containing and keeping at bay. But he's thinking back as he's looking at this and looking at the present struggle, he's thinking back to things that he knows about God, that the things that he's remembered that God has done before. And that's good to do. I mean, that is a great thing to do in times of trouble and difficult times that we face, is to go back into our own history and remember those times that we've seen God's hand at work. It's actually a good case for journaling at times, or keeping prayer journals and things like that, writing things down that we remember that God's done, because we can go back to that and remind ourselves of that. That's an important thing. The Israelites all the time were creating memorials where they went to remind themselves of what God has done. And that's an important part of encouraging ourselves in our faith, to remember what God's done before and believing that he'll do it again. We as human beings are so quick to forget. We're so quick to forget the blessings that we've had. I know in my own experience, I can walk right away from an amazing answer to prayer, face another problem, and be immediately like, oh, no, there's no hope. It's all over. Because we're just like that as human beings. We've got short attention spans. MTV's perfect for us because, we're always chasing after whatever's shiny, and we're quick to forget those things that God has done. It's important to remind ourselves of those things. That's another reason why the word is so important, the recorded word here, that we can go back and look at what God's done for people in the past. We go back into our own lives, the testimonies of those around us, and we know that God's been at work. And for him, it causes his faith to rebound. He remembers that God does hear us. He will hear us. He will act. Maybe not in the time frame that we wanted or desired, but he will act. He will make things right. There is a good ending to this story, this great story that's been unfolding. A good ending coming. We have to believe that. And so the victories of those that oppose God mostly thinking in terms of our enemy Satan, they are temporary. They won't last. But this section here at the end begins with those words, the Lord is king forever. That'll never change. He is king now. He was king back then. He will always be king. The enemy, our enemy, the enemy of our souls can do some damage, can run around and do some things here, but it's all temporary. It's not going to last. It's not going to last forever. It will come to an end. Every trial that we're going through right now will come to an end. It's temporary. But the Lord, he's king forever. That's never going to change. He's always going to be king. He's always going to be king. The same yesterday, today, and forever. That's never going to change. And we can find a great deal of hope in that, to know those things. He has heard, he says. I like that it says that he has heard. You have heard the desire of the humble. It didn't get past him. Didn't slip through the cracks. Somebody forgot to give him. It didn't slide into the junk mail folder. He knew. He heard. He always hears. That's so important to remember that when we're going through difficult times, when we can't seem to get a handle on why these things are happening, when it feels like God's far, far away and we can't seem to connect with him, always remember this. He hears us no matter what. No matter what we're hearing. No matter what we're able to even concentrate on or focus on, he always hears us. He always hears us. So that gives us great encouragement to keep talking to him. Keep talking to him. Keep complaining to him. Keep asking for those things that we have need of. Keep asking for his deliverance because he hears. He always hears. He never fails to hear us. And then it says he will. He has heard and he will prepare our hearts. And that word for prepare can mean to make preparations for, but it equally can mean to establish, which given the context, I think is more the appropriate translation for this, that he establishes our hearts. That means that he provides that sense of security and stability that we need inwardly. You know, it's a wonderful thing. Even when things are difficult in the circumstances around us, if we are calm, if we have that sense, that knowledge that it's all right, I know who I belong to, I know where I'm going in this, I know whom I believed in, I'm persuaded he's able to hang on to me and keep me to the end of this whole ride when it's done. That's a great thing. I mean, circumstance, honestly, that is better than even having the circumstances change. That's what Paul was trying to say. Paul in 2 Corinthians 12:9 makes that statement. He was facing all kinds of difficulties and he kept asking the Lord over and over again, Lord, will you take this away? And the Lord finally spoke to him and said, look, my grace is sufficient for you. In other words, my grace is the answer that you're looking for in this. More so than the change in the circumstances. My grace, the knowledge that I'm here and present with you in the midst of this, is even better than actually having those circumstances change. Hard to understand, but that's what he says. And he goes on to make that other ridiculous statement that his strength is made complete, is revealed perfectly in our weaknesses. That, in other words, his ability to provide that strength and that calmness to our souls is present in those times when things are falling apart around us and we are incapable of making anything change on our own. His presence, his grace in the midst of that is better even than the circumstances changing. Why? Because he's there. Because what could be better than that? He's there. He's right there with us. Paul said that in his last trial, no one stood with me, but Jesus stood with me. Jesus, right there with us in the midst of the things that we face. His strength being made perfect in our weaknesses. He provides that sense of security, even though it looks like he's far away. He's near. He's very near. He's right in our very own hearts. God with us, Emmanuel. So this prayer, this poem tells us something very important, that it's not the circumstances that we face or the evil that gets perpetrated in this world that defines us. What defines us is that God is with us, no matter what's happening all around us, that we are people who are united with God. That's what defines us. That's what defined the psalmist at the end of this. So when the pressure's on, we just have to remember, no matter how bad it looks, we can trust God. We can trust God based on even what is said here, that he will arise. He has heard us. He will lift his hand and help us and provide for us. He won't forget the afflicted. But best of all, maybe best of all, he's king forever. And that's never going to change. So, Father, we just thank you so much for your word to us. We thank you for these prayers, these poems that use a kind of language that can awaken something else in us. It's not just facts, Lord. It's deeper than that. It resonates with us. And I just pray, Lord, that you by your Spirit will accomplish what you want to accomplish in our lives as we submit ourselves to this word. As we come here like this and gather together and explore it together, I just pray that it has its effect on us and that we change because of it. Make us a people, Father, who can trust you, who find that sense of stability and strength, even in the midst of trouble, as we look to you. I pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.